through all of that, what the hell is Abe Yurkson doing? I would say that it's there's more, you know, there's other things I'm doing that I haven't spoken about, but there's one thing that undergirds all of it.
That's what we want.
Yeah, that's the movement away from primacy.
Listen. For Abe Yurkson, it's an active verb. Active not in the sense that he's giving you nonverbal feedback, just active in the sense that, well, he may be busy constructing an internal model, a concept of who you are. You see, Abe may be planning to create an entire world around you, either just by his friendship, or maybe a particular act of thoughtfulness, or even by designing and choreographing an elaborate 3-day odyssey, which is a collaborative performance art based upon you and performed for you alone by his team of artists from Odyssey Works. You see, Abe Bergson is actively listening. Today's episode is a great opportunity for you to listen. And not just to Abe, but to whatever it is that makes your heart burn.
It's probably more complicated than that.
If there's anything that undergirds Abe's diverse body of work, it is his passion to help us understand that as people, as artists, we can and are to design experiences, not just things. While I am not at all inclined to tell you what to think or do or feel as you listen to one of these podcasts, I do want to be a little bit transparent today about my intentions. I'm hoping that I have designed the experience of today's episode in such a way that you will experience two separate love notes. One is the love note of the affection and the appreciation that I have for Abe Yurkson as an artist and as a person. But as you listen to that and the very nature of his work and the things that drive him, the second love note that I hope that you begin to experience is one that will exist in the future. I hope you'll find some inspiration, some spark of love that helps you to start to design and to create a loving experience, a love note for someone to whom you have or can actively listen. I guess it's also my hope that you know that all of these episodes are my love note to you in appreciation for who you are and for what everything that is that we could be. If you want to make sure other people can get in on the love, all you have to do is subscribe, rate, review, and even share on your social media, and that's just an invitation for other people to join in this ongoing conversation. I know Abe well enough to know that he's an ordinary person, but what you're about to experience is that he's a truly exceptional human, and I hope that helps you see that so are you. Hi, I'm Doug Harrison, and this is The Heartburn. Abe Yurkson is the founding director of the Odyssey Works Group, and they are known for their innovative way of creating these sometimes quite elaborate performances for an audience of one person, and that performance is based upon that person. Some of them have been quite extraordinary. And full disclosure, I was one of the participants or subjects or audience members of a work done by Abe and some of his friends back in 2007. So I've been on the inside of one of these experiences.
But before we actually have him break it down and talk about some of his philosophy of art and other things, I wanted him to just give us a little context for why what he is doing, he and his team, is so incredibly important for art in this particular moment in time. So let's let him tell us a thing or two about just experience and art and what it has to do with form and how he got here.
You know, I was so deeply moved by 13 ways of looking at a blackbird. Deeply. Now that's,
it's what was that, 13 ways of looking at
a blackbird, the Wallace Stevens poem. Like, that's, it's amazing. And what made that great was not, you know, whether it won a prize or it was in this journal or who wrote it or, you know, what the intellectual interpretation was. What made it great was the way it went directly into me and changed my way of understanding the world, right? And I don't think, like, I think that's powerful and important. I don't think it's unique. I think everybody I meet who is interested in art has at some point had that experience. And so, you know, we go to, you know, you go to grad school, or you go to the Association of Writers and Writing Programs conference, and you forget, you're like, you can't find that metric of success in the evaluation of the works you're looking at, right? The metrics are, you know, how many people showed up at your show, how many people bought your book, what did this one critic say? All of these things, which are all entirely external metrics. And some of them may be very good in certain ways. The same applies to architecture, to music, to all these things. They're all external metrics. And I think the work that we were doing this last week is the work that I'm most interested in right now, which is turning people back to that metric. And I think I don't think people get away from it sort of, you know, capriciously. I think it's that there's no support. You don't write a play and then have a long conversation with an audience member about the inner experience of that play. You write a play and then you get flowers and people talk about how great it was, or you don't, you know, or nobody accepts it. Or you write a poem even and you send it to 100 journals and get rejected by 99, but one of them was the good journal, and like somebody, like, you know, somebody said that it reminds them of X and Y. Like the distance between that and the experience of being moved is so far. You know, likewise, you know, what is acting? You know, it's like it's all this external support, and there is still a seed, right? There's still an effect, and it was never, that seed was never given, it was never put in the front seat of the why. It was never put into the grant's application primary question. It was never made central to the creative process in an external way.
Let me ask then, to what extent do you think that what you're describing, this move away from the internal motivations to the external, is that just sort of the human condition, that as we do more art and we just try to share it, that that's where feedback lives? Or to what extent is that the culture's moment of us being a capitalist society and needing products and generating meaningful work, having value, et cetera, et cetera? I mean, I'm trying to ask that as the least pretentious way as I possibly can.
Yeah.
And it just isn't that
way. Yeah. Yeah. It's I think it's a lot of things. And I always come back to the George Oppen poem Of Being Numerous, which has been my favorite poem since for a while. Hmm. And he says, we have chosen the meaning of being numerous. And there's all these compromises that come when you move out of tiny little communities into this larger community of strangers that is living in cities, that is living in a society, that is like conceptualizing a whole nation to which you relate, right? Like the idea that you're making work for the culture is a relatively new one in human history, although it does, you know, it does go back many hundreds of years, but you know, it was a pretty esoteric idea for a long time that you'd be making work that wasn't for your community. I mean, if we look at the source of most art through most of human history, which is the church or the temple or the religious community, we see that that work is generally made for that community to have a particular experience, right? And
often has a narrative purpose to it. It's extending a particular narrative of that community, of that faith. This is what happened. Don't forget these things.
Right. Right. And you know, it's you know, what happens, and I'm not an art historian, so my understanding of these things is pretty loose, but what happened when people started making work for the general public was a move away from that and a move towards this amazing thing, which is that you can now through art understand the experiences of people unlike yourself, the experiences of people foreign to yourself, right? And as a regular practice, as a regular part of art practice. So this is like the joy of it. But what comes with it is that art moves into the way we generally relate to the larger culture, which is through market economics, through, yeah. You know, I'm wary of saying capitalism because it brings on this whole narrative that I don't want to get into, but you know, it does bring us right face to face with the fact that our work is moving into the culture in much the same way that our goods move into the culture, right? You make a widget and you sell it through the marketplace and it's evaluated in that way. And the same thing with our work, which is weird and largely a failure. It fails to support the things that are at the heart of what we do. So it's important to question that. I mean, we, you know, why do we have a kind of market-based approach to poetry when even the U.S. Poet Laureate could never live on what she makes as U.S. Poet Laureate, right? Like the number one poet in the nation, you know, still needs a day job, right? Like it's not working in market economics, so why let it move through that system? So part of the liberation of the way that Odyssey Works works is by moving outside of that system in large part, is by stepping out, just the simple move of saying, you know, we don't need to evaluate the quality of our work based on, you know, sales, butts in seats, reviews by anonymous people. Just like the ripple effects of that are enormous.
Let's talk for just a second about karaoke. It's an exercise we do to create a sense of community. It's social. And in many ways, it's comparable to the old-fashioned community porch sing. But way back upon a time when we had the old-fashioned community sing with maybe perhaps handmade instruments, and I'm definitely romanticizing here, but we would sing songs about our faith. And we would sing songs that we have written about our community and about our story and about what we knew. With karaoke, not only am I repeating a song specifically designed to be appealing to millions of people usually, but my performance is also going to be compared to the person whose performance appeals to millions of people. And this is not just a matter of us talking about local versus global or more general. But if you think about it, if we leave art only to the professionals to be made, then how very few of us will ever be creating, especially for each other.
It's probably more complicated than that.
We'll be right back.
Ah, everybody, put down your ice cream cone and let go of your labradoodle. I have big news, which is related to this podcast. Abe Berkson is going to be with Aiden LaRue in Austin, Texas, providing one of their intensive weekend workshops. It's through the 787 Collective.
And we will put a link to it in this particular podcast. So keep an eye out for that. But in it, it'll be an experience design workshop, and they'll be focusing on developing a relationship with your audience, using their interview process, developing that sense of curiosity and intimacy with your audience. All of those sorts of things based upon this little doing creative stuff for an audience of one. It is from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. October 12th and 13th. It is $395. There's some partial scholarships will be available. So please go to the 787 Collective in Austin, Texas, and look for the links here, because I will probably be there and I'll want to see your face. You can pick up your Labradoodle again by...
Listen. And don't just listen to Abe speak, but here, listen specifically to how he experienced flow by listening intricately and carefully to one of his subjects and trying to immerse himself in that person's experience of the world. And how different is that than singing along with an Ariana Grande song?
Just the simple move of saying, you know, we don't need to evaluate the quality of our work based on, you know, sales, butts in seats, reviews by anonymous people. Just like the ripple effects of that are enormous.
Wasn't the New York Times say, I'll get it wrong here, the beautiful inefficiency?
Yeah, yeah.
Of Odyssey Works, because, and this is actually a great segue in just taking a step back and saying, I will let listeners find out for themselves by buying your book, Odyssey Works, what Odyssey Works is precisely. But in brief, it is designed experiences for an audience of one person based upon that person's life or circumstance or knowledge of that person in some way, based upon that person. Mm-hmm. So incredibly inefficient in that the audience is a singular person, but then also engages all the things you're talking about. So suddenly all of your performers, actors / infiltrators are now having experiences of their own by reflecting on this person, by working together, by experiencing flow as they did in Ithaca this weekend. So mm-hmm. Okay, great. We have a small, quick picture. Maybe you can help us get further into what you're already saying. Do you have a particular moment in which you experienced flow, or that there's an experience that you guys designed with Odyssey Works that you feel a particular sense of pride or experience something a little more ecstatic or flow than usual in the process?
Yeah, I've been thinking about this a lot. Actually, but before I say that, I'm really happy you plugged my book, and I think everybody in the world should go out and read it. But I should also say a book came out like last week by Rick Moody, and we made an Odyssey for Rick Moody in 2013. And this book has a chapter about his Odyssey. And so I've been reading that. And if you want to kind of get an insider's view on what it's like to be the recipient of one of these, I'd recommend picking that up. It's pretty
fun. We'll put up links to both. Yes.
Cool. I teach thesis students, design thesis students. And for some reason this year, a lot of them were interested in this question, the question of flow and what gets you into flow and what the utility of it is. I'm very interested in it too. I'm not sure that any of us came to some really simple analytical understanding of it. I saw a diagram recently about how flow was sort of this kind of, I forget what it was, this sort of step diagram, and flow was this kind of line in the middle, and it's when your capacity and your capacity and the difficulty are kind of pushed just at the right point enough that you sort of enter into this flow state. I'm not sure that diagram isn't too simplified. I've been thinking about this a lot. I've been thinking about one particular moment in one of the Odysseys where I was in this state of flow, and what it
what I learned from that, that I could share with people. There was this participant, that's what we call the person we make an Odyssey for, named Carl. And it was interesting because we didn't like, not that we understand anybody completely right off, but we really didn't understand him that well. And we were intrigued. We were trying to see why he thought the way he thought, why he lived the way he lived. He was so smart, so smart. I mean, really, just really intelligent, but also like lost in thought a lot, would fall down the stairs, very analytical. And your general kind of idea about this might be that, you know, this is somebody who doesn't have a powerful emotional life, that it's all an intellectual life, but he did. He had this extraordinary emotional life. His love of his friends was something that I think back on a lot. He never took it for granted. He never took his friends for granted. And he always thought about each one individually. It wasn't like, ah, that's my people. There was this consideration that was continuous and specific. And that really touched us. We didn't know kind of why he got there and how he got there, how you get through these very abstract ideas to love of friends. And that said, this is not really what I'm going to talk about, actually. But the curiosity meant that I couldn't just sort of assume I knew how he thought. And I was looking for a way in. And we found out that he was going to a lecture on mapping. And we sent somebody to tail him at the lecture, to be an actor, to enter his life, but also to report back on what this lecture was about and how he responded. And they did. And I got the report and I saw that he was in love with mapping, not because he liked the graphics, not because he was so interested in learning more data. He was interested in it because there's this quality to mapping, which is almost Kabbalistic, which is if you overlay things in the right way, if you do this sort of magical process of throwing data at a territory enough, you'll find out some hidden truth. And he loved that. And I kind of loved that idea too. I don't know that I believed it. I'm not sure that it's not just a fanciful idea that never finds any truth. But I love the idea anyway, right? It's like something from a great novel where you're just like, your hero has figured out the way to understand how the world works by overlaying these maps. And I loved it, but I didn't fully get it. And I knew this was my way into understanding him. So I spent 3 days reading about mapping, making maps, writing about mapping, and ultimately scripting an NPR radio show about mapping that he would hear, that he would wake up to in the morning when his alarm clock was going off with the radio playing this particular show that was designed to speak directly to his interests. And so it was a really interesting demand. Like we were talking about before, it's not like whether this is objectively a good radio show. The demand was that this radio show has to speak to his specific understanding of mapping in a way that touches him in that particular Kabbalistic way. You know what I mean? And
help me know what you mean. One way I could say this back to you is that this is sort of a buckshot approach to truth. And I don't think that's quite getting at it, that if you just throw enough one direction, something's likely to land. But that's not what I'm hearing you saying. To you,
it's no.
Relying transparencies that if you stack them up, you get an image that's...
Yeah, it's more like that. And it's like, it sort of doesn't matter for the story in a way, but it's like this. You can, you take the map of the city, but what is the map of the city? I don't know, the streets, the houses, is it the payphones? They don't exist anymore. Is it streetlights? Is it where everybody's hanging out? Like, what makes a map of the city? But you find a base map of the city, one that closely represents the territory. And then you start putting other things on it, like parade routes, a garbage pickup, litter, wealth status of different houses, the weather. You move it through time. Right? And patterns magically emerge. And these patterns tell you where the heart of the city is, say, or they tell you, you know, that every time a certain amount of trash and garbage and disorder piles up in one area, in another area, somebody gets wealthy, right? There's these connections which would not be visible had you not started overlaying these data patterns on the map and begun to see what emerges. It's like a little close to some of the chaos theory ideas from way back when. James Corner wrote a great essay called The Agency of Mapping, which talks about some of these ideas really well. And so we got into it, and it was close to, I'm really interested in diagramming as a way of exploring and expressing graphically larger views of processes, and it's how I do most of the Odysseys. But I was also interested in mapping, which is part of diagramming. And so with this look, which is the process of writing this, of doing the mapping of all of these things that I was doing there, meant that I had to not only sort of enact the action of it, but I had to try to find in me the particular subjectivity around that desire, the desire for the truth to reveal itself, like, you know, like Indiana Jones, you know, doing a grave rubbing, trying to find the secret, you know, the secret pattern which tells him where the grail is buried. It's that kind of desire. Right, but in a more data analytical way. That's how I was coming at it. And I spent these 3 days trying to find that. And then I wrote the script, and we, you know, we recorded it and made this radio show out of it, which was fake. But on the morning he woke up to that radio show playing on his clock radio, and he was so glad NPR had finally put something out that spoke so directly to him. And it wasn't until it repeated that he, you know, rubbed his eyes and was like, wait, I don't have a clock radio. And why is this show repeating? And did they just say that if you want to find out more, you have to get down to this cafe, to my favorite cafe, in 15 minutes? Right? So he ran out the door. But it was the process of making that, which was the process, which was almost like an acting process of trying to step into this other subjectivity, which connected to mine, it connected to what I love, but it was a different way. And it was through reading, it was through drawing, it was through all these different methodologies that I was able to get into this kind of flow state. But what drove it was a curiosity and an emotional longing. I longed to know what it was like to have this emotional, intellectual connection through this idea.
Probably more complicated than that.
What drove it was a curiosity and an emotional longing.
We'll be right back.
Whew. There's a reason here at the Heartburn we talk about the importance of turning our assumptions into curiosities. When you look at how far Abe's curiosity took him along even just his own journey by empathizing with someone else, it helps to see the contrast of that of how very far a conclusion won't usually take us. But let's listen for just a little bit to Abe to see if we can empathize with what's going on in the way that he experiences the world.
So to what extent is that what Abe Burrickson is doing? Is you are an architect, you are a published author, you are now, some would say, a conceptual artist, you're an experienced design artist, you are a poet. You're a multifaceted individual who I won't call a polymath, but truly a Renaissance man, and that people know this about you. Is this a Burrickson laying transparency of a map on top of a transparency of a map of your experience and of longing and curiosity, trying to make sense out of truth, truthfulness in the world as you see it?
I like that description. If I can take your question as, you know, through all of that, what the hell is Abe Burrickson doing? I would say that it's there's more, you know, there's other things I'm doing that I haven't spoken about, but there's one thing that undergirds all of it.
That's what we want to know.
Yeah. And that's the movement away from the primacy of form towards the primacy of experience in creative practice, and both on a pedagogical side and a practical side. And that sounds a little dismissive of form, right? It sounds like you don't care if what the thing looks like, but I believe that it's that this way of thinking about the things we make, it reasserts the importance of form. It reasserts the importance of craft in what we do, because when you take away because there's this obsession with form, and there's this obsession with what it looks like, what it's shaped up, talking about the thing itself that
help me understand this. I just, because there's a couple $2 words in there, and I want to make sure I've got a good sense of what this is, what this actually looks like. So you talk about the primacy of form and the primacy of experience. I want to say, like what?
Okay. Like, for instance, I'm an architect. I teach in architecture schools, right?
Yeah.
And what's architecture? Right? We talk about is architecture buildings? What is the job of the architect? What are we designing? What are we actually making? Right? Actually, our products as architects are these drawings that are ultimately on paper, if not only in digital form. That's what we make, right? That's the product we produce. And that product eventually is used to create a physical structure, right? And if we think of it that way, which is probably the standard way of thinking about it, the architect makes a thing. The architect makes a building. But what's a building? A building, not to get too abstract, but a building is a place where we do things, right? A home is a place where we live, maybe with our families, maybe with our friends, maybe alone. A home is a place, but isn't it interesting, this word home, right? Home is not just house. I have a house is different than saying I have a home. Home is the stories of our lives. Home is the way we eat. Home is the way we sleep. Home is the way we make love. Home is the way we study and learn and try to be better and give in to our faults or resist them. Home is where our families grow and shrink, and where people leave and they come back home. You can live in a different house, but you're still coming home. Home is made possible by the structure, right? Now, are we designing buildings, edifices, or are we designing homes? The two, like layers on a map, lay right on top of each other, right? And if you think about your design process in terms of the primacy of form, you're making a house. And then what's next? What does it look like? That is the first and often the last question that is asked of a structure. What does it look like? What color is it? Is it Tudor? Is it modern? Is it too boxy? Right? All these things that our image-obsessed culture drives us towards, right? Then what's next? You know, how much does it cost, right? And where, you know, all these things that forget about the fact that we are creating a life. We are facilitating a life. And if you've ever lived in a terrible house, if you've ever lived in a space that made you depressed, you understand that it's not a minor matter. If the ceiling is too low, if the lighting is too bad, you get depressed. You cannot live the life you wish to live. If the materiality is too fake, is too artificial, something is not possible. Something is not supported. We've all walked into spaces that change who we are.
And so to go back to what you were saying earlier to answer my last question, which is you talk about the primacy of form and the primacy of experience. You are an architect who, yes, you make designs for buildings, but your deeper question is, how do I design a home? What are you going to experience here? How are those related? And it's that recovery of experience in designing the building that is where you have your passion.
Exactly. I say, what is the life you want to live? And we figure that out, and then we can design the structure. Likewise, with these performances, if we say, we get together as a group and we say, what is the experience? What is the inner experience we want our audience to have first? Then we draw it out in a diagram. And then we say, oh, okay, well, then we need a dance scene here. And then we'll probably need him to read a book. And then we'll need to write this story that he hears on the radio or something like this. Then he needs to hear this piece of music over and over and over again. That means the form comes after the intent, because we understand the life that is facilitated by that form first. And this is in all things. There's no creative practice that cannot be considered in this fashion.
This is also one of your 6 points of your Odyssey Works book, that design experiences, not things.
Yes.
So as you're thinking of being creative for your audience member, singular, again, you're thinking in terms of experience for every piece of the artwork that you're putting together for this person?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I want to say, and I want to be totally clear, I think what this does is demand a revitalization of craft. And I'll give you an example. We had to write this book.
And by that,
therefore form. Yeah. I don't, you know, it's very tempting to say, if you're just designing experiences, it doesn't matter like what the thing is. And I want to say craft is more important now. We, for this very same Odyssey that we created for this guy, Carl, there was a book that we wanted him to read. And it was a book of short stories by Jorge Luis Borges. And, you know, there were various different sort of conceits around it. So it said it was written by Zul Solar, who was a friend of his, but we made up a controversy and pretended that perhaps Borges actually wrote it. Because we knew this guy knew Borges' entire oeuvre, nothing has been translated into English by Zul Solar, so we had kind of free space there. So we wrote this, and we worked really hard to make sure it was in the voice of Borges. I worked with about 5 or 6 writers who, one of them I just saw who participated in this last Odyssey in the public scene, named Bob Pohl, just comes to mind. And each one studied a particular style of Borges' writing in order to write a story. And then those stories eventually led to the narrative threads that were in Carl's experience, right? But we needed him to read these stories, but we needed him to read them as if they were actually written by Borges. They were not as if we'd said, here's a book of stories that seem to be written by Borges, wink, wink, I know you know, it's all just fiction. So we wrote it, we had it printed, we took it to a book preservation lab. Book preservation is very much about aging paper, actually, to fill in. Hold on a sec.
Yes.
These old books are missing pages often. You need to fill in with new paper, but you have to age it to look like the old paper. So we went to this lab, right, who aged it for us to make it look like it would have been printed in 1980, which was when it was when the our Library of Congress catalog page said it was printed. And then we wrote in it various things as if it had been through many hands. And then we had to go on Wikipedia and insert an entry about it into Wikipedia in English and in Spanish, because it's a Spanish book. Right? We had to build this world in a credible way. There couldn't be any cracks in it. You know, he knew that he was entering into a bit of a manufactured world, a bit of a designed life when he started his odyssey. He just didn't know which parts were and which parts weren't.
Because
we wanted to keep it that way.
Without excellence of craft at that point, you don't get the willful suspension of disbelief there. He
right.
can't really fall into the fiction if it looks like something Doug wrote, he's not going to have the experience that you're really wanting to design for him.
Right, exactly. I mean, it's great, you know, the experience of reading something like, oh, it's as if Borges wrote this is great. But the experience of reading something saying, oh, wow, Borges wrote this, is a totally different one. And that's where craft comes in. You know, there are so many things like that, you know, just listening to a piece of music and thinking, oh, that's, you know, that sounds classical. And it reminds me of Beethoven. They're trying to sound like Beethoven. It's very different than writing something that affects you in the same way Beethoven affects you, you know, or Bach, right? That's why craft is more important in this at this juncture, right?
So let me, I understand, and since I know you and have known some of your work, like I get it when you describe this this passion for experience and creating these experiences for people. And so my next question is as simple as just why? What is it for Abe Burickson that he wants to create these magical, by which I mean these well-crafted experiences that seem to come into existence precisely for a person as if they're part of a greater universe? Why is that meaningful to you, and why do you go to such great lengths so as to build really a good portion of your life around this kind of work?
Geez, it seems so obvious to me. I'm just like, well, come on. Don't we want as artists, right? Isn't it rewarding when people are affected by your work? Isn't that what we want? And I think, like, you know, people are successful. They sell books, or they, you know, get their face on the silver screen or whatever, and they feel a kind of an emptiness because it's disconnected from the actual effect on the audience. It's selfish. I want my work to affect people, but what artist doesn't? The problem is that we're not in a world that designs the way art making works around that. I want to change that. I want to at least open the option, and I think that's what this does.
And keep in mind also that part of our audience, like, so far I've spoken to a PhD who's an expert in the emerging church movement, a female pastor in a conservative congregation that is pastoring her church to understand the immigration crisis better on the San Diego border. We have a woman who, because of her Christian faith, is doing some of the most important trans work in central Texas. We have someone who's been trapped in a cult for 2 years. So these aren't all artists that we're necessarily speaking to. So part of the question that remains in the room for you and I is, why even be an artist? Why do you want to impact people, or and especially to do it through a medium?
Yeah. There's a couple things. One is, it's a deep belief of mine that we all have a kind of calling. There's a brilliance in every person, and it's important to find that. And if it's to be an artist, then it is the calling that you're called to find. And it's such a beautiful thing to be around somebody who is enmeshed in their calling. I used to be a carpenter and it wasn't my calling. I loved it. It wasn't my calling, but to be around these old guys who had been working with wood their whole lives, 70 years old, just so graceful, a beautiful thing. It's their calling. So there's that in a sense, which, you know, when I'm doing this work, it feels like the work I should be doing. There's that. But also, I think it makes the world a better place. You know, there's so much that's awful out there, and there's an ethical question in front of us all, which is how do you respond? And I think it's really important to struggle with. And when I was 20. 1995, I was in Israel, and I was sitting on the Sea of Galilee, actually, right on the banks of the Sea of Galilee, not capable of avoiding the symbolism of that particular body of water. Talking to this guy who had just been working in a refugee camp in, I guess it wasn't Rwanda, but right outside Rwanda, but he'd been living in Rwanda, and the genocide had just happened. And it was the most horrible thing I could imagine. And he had saved lives in country, and then he worked in the refugee camp, saving lives there. And it hit me so hard, it hit me really hard. Right, this sort of ethical demand. How do we respond to a world like this? And the obvious answer is that you fight against evil, right? Which is what he was doing. Fight against the effects of evil, fight against the horrors. And I struggled with that for a long time, because what he did was clearly not my calling. And I thought maybe I should just drop it all and go to med school and make a difference that way, and I can work in these places. And I struggled with that a lot. And I was writing a lot of poetry back then and reading poetry. And I remember I picked up a Robert Haas book. It was a poet I loved, and I read it, and it occurred to me that this made life worth living. That this existed in the world. And it's funny, you know, you think of yourself like, you know, I'm going to save lives versus I'm going to write a couple of ditties. It doesn't seem to compare. Right? But then I think about like what we've all been given by Shakespeare, by Robert Haas, by Susan Sontag, like these people do what is, they put into the world what makes it worth saving lives for. And it's not just in this kind of Western idea of art. I think it's everywhere I've ever been, right? The creative practices, they generate for the world why we want to save lives, why we want to have children, why we want to keep living, because there is this infinite depth and somebody needs to be plumbing it.
Just one more time, I want to say that Abe Burrickson and his assistant director, Aiden LaRue, are doing an intensive Odyssey Works workshop here in Austin, Texas, at the Austin Presbyterian Seminary as part of the 787 Collective. Notes will be in our notes section, so please check them out and join us, or look for the 787 Collective online, and then look for the Odyssey Works workshop. Also, I want to let you know that this weekend is the last weekend for you to leave a review and to win an experience design consultation with me and one of my coworkers at the Xanatos Gambit Meta Detective Agency, where we do similar stuff as Abe. So don't forget to leave a review right now, and we'll be reaching out to someone in the next couple of days to tell you that you've won.
Because you're getting at one of the deeper questions I want to get at, and that is, like, how did you hear this call? You're called to be this kind of artist. You're working on this craft to press it forward. And, you know, we can put it together that you read some poetry, you tried writing poetry, and you became a poet, and you got pretty good at it. And then you followed that to a certain place, and it led you somewhere else. But there also seems to be a degree of spiritual attunement or practice, at least in some of our other guests, that's necessary for hearing your call, or at least recognizing when you're hearing a call as opposed to something else, an interest. You know, this is a hobby or this is my call, sound different. Where does your attunement to the voice of your calling come from? And I also happen to know, I know that in your father's life and in your own, that you had interest in the work of Gurdjieff, that there's some spiritual practice that goes, if it's called spiritual, I don't know, philosophical practice that goes with Gurdjieff's work. So help me out understanding the becoming behind the vocational interest.
Yeah. So yes, I have had a spiritual practice for many years, and I suppose you could say that in my 20s I was a seeker, if that phrase still works. And I was always interested in art because I was always touched by art, and there was some how can I put it? Affinity with the mystery that both art and the spiritual search have. And I always felt it, right? Something that moves you artistically is something that is often in touch with a level you don't understand. And that is the mystical question as well. And so for me, these two have long been aligned. And I can go back to in that same year, 1995, when I dropped out of college and went to the Middle East, specifically to Turkey, to live with the whirling dervishes and learn the whirling and other practices. And the whirling is dance, right? It's a form of dance. It's part of a practice called Sema, which is basically translated as audition, which is to say art, hearing, playing, practicing art practices, largely practiced as poetry, dance, and music, mystical practices, which are designed to elevate the consciousness into a Gnostic state. They say when you practice the whirling, you transcend the seven veils right to the doorstep of God. That's amazing, right? right, that's amazing. Like, I couldn't believe that there were people who not only saw the affinity between these two, but were practicing it. I mean, I knew that there was music in church. I knew that there was poetry in you know, the Song of Solomon, right? Like, I knew that the arts and spiritual practices were not divided, but I just hadn't seen it so tight, so close together, so explicit. And so that's why I went. I went to Turkey, and that was actually when I came around to being an architect, because I was not an architect. That wasn't something I was close to being. And I just kept walking into those incredible mosques and the Hagia Sophia, which not originally a mosque, but these incredible religious structures all over Istanbul, and feeling myself physiologically, narratively, and spiritually changed in the time of being in that space. And it made clear to me that aesthetic practices and the spiritual search were of a piece. And so I came home and rededicated myself to that. I decided not to become a doctor. I decided that if I could change lives with art, that was my calling. And I didn't know how that was going to be. And I took a tortuous path that led me to this particular practice by accident, by luck of friendships, by chance encounters with ideas.
Now, when you've talked about the importance and the role of longing, we've talked about, and by the way, that is your son Sherwin in the background singing along with us. And is welcome to the. We've talked about longing. We've now talked about mystery. This is all in the context of art. Those are all sorts of things that that are. They have a lot of Annie Dillard would call waxiness, a lot of softness and ambiguity to them. And I know in our world today, there seems to be a fair amount of allergy to ambiguity or to mystery. How do you sustain living a life that pulls you into longing, that pulls you in deeper into mystery as opposed to out of it and into definition, salty, clarity, hard stuff?
I don't know. That's a great question. I gotta keep asking myself that. I'll tell you right now.
I can turn that around and just say, for today or in this season, what makes this difficult work sustainable?
Yeah, I'll tell you right now, it's changing diapers. I mean, it's the very practical mundane of what it is to have a kid right now. Like, I'm learning so much from this, and I've just been lamenting how awful it is when your favorite authors have kids and start talking only about having kids, but oh well, I'm here, right? There's like this incredible collision of the sacred and poop that happens when you have a baby, and it's happening right here, that screaming. Like, it doesn't bother me. I'm sorry. I hope it doesn't ruin this interview, but like, I love to hear it. You know, I try to stop it, but I love to hear everything that comes out of it. There's this incredible struggle that has to happen between the practical of poop and the sacred of bringing myself to the moment with him. And it's a spiritual practice. And it is this same question in a different form of experience and form of what is the experience you're trying to create with this work, and what is the form in which it's going to manifest. And that happens in teaching, and that happens in architecture practice. It's this trying to keep it all together. I used to call it the God iPhone axis. That's actually it's the name of my phone and whatever its identity, right? Like somewhere there's God, which is formless everything. And down here, there's the ultimate manifestation, which is your iPhone. And they're not against each other. It's just an axis. Like the best moment on this axis is if you could get the phone number for God and just make that call along that string, like a tin can telephone, right? There's that's what it is. And so, money is an interesting thing, right? Like, having to deal with the finances of your work is so repugnant in many ways. And a lot of the stuff I talked about was about like getting away from those metrics. But in fact, the money is related to how people relate to your work in the world, right? Like, there's it measures something, and it's usually something you don't want to look at in a certain sense when you're an artist, and it's something that causes all kinds of emotional reactions. But this is my life in the world, right? So like, this is the work, and so there's this movement between the two that is really sustaining. I wake up in the morning with this baby. We just lay around in bed and look at each other, and right, like, holy cow, I get to do this. And it's great. And at the same time, there's like, you know, all these practical things that have to happen, including money.
Mm. Well, the Benedictine motto is Ora et Labora, which is work and pray. And again, there's something very concrete and of the very esoteric in that all at once. I want to thank you so much for giving us time. We always try to make it a practice of expressing our appreciation. What I can say to you is that as you obviously think as an academic and a philosopher and are a brilliant human being and articulate these ideas, your commitment to excellence, especially in craft, is something that I've been personally a beneficiary of, both as been connected to some of your art and read your poetry, as well as just had you as a friend. So, but as in this world of these speculative ideas and in your quest for excellence in the concrete in your practice, I would not be the same without Abe Bergson in my life, and clearly the better for it. And I hope that, and I think it'll be clear that our listeners will experience very much the same. So you being exercising excellence, just in being able to share your thoughts, seems to be part of the art form, and hopefully we're all a little close to our calling because of it.
At the outset, I had hoped that you would develop an appreciation not just for Abe, but for somebody else, perhaps, and begin to think of them and what sort of love note you could write to them. Look, when we do this, we don't have to be skilled like Ariana Grande is skilled, but what she will never do is sing to your spouse by their name. Tell your community's story as they understand it, or share faith with a small group of people that have been on that journey with you. Our form matters. It is to us to find what our vocation is and to do it to the best of our ability. But there are a million, well, an infinite number of ways of creating love notes to the people that have helped to make your story what it is. On my best days, I like to think I've been something of that for you. And if we want to be that for each other, all we have to do to begin is listen. These are just ordinary people, maybe ordinary like you, but exceptional human beings, also maybe like you. My name is Doug Harrison.
And I'm inviting you to listen to What Makes Your Heart Burn.